Hello, and welcome to the Oxford Ukraine Hub podcast, a series of podcasts brought to you from the University of Oxford.
The Oxford Ukraine Hub is an interdisciplinary network connecting expertise across the University of Oxford with international researchers and practitioners working on Ukraine-related issues. By placing Ukraine at the center of scholarly inquiry, we try to disrupt long-established epistemological hierarchies within Slavic and East European studies.
Our podcast series brings together diverse voices and perspectives to explore Ukraine's past, present, and future through various disciplinary lenses. In 2025 and 2026, we are running a series of seminars. Today's episode features three panelists from our workshop called Consolidating the State, Challenges and Opportunities in Post-War Reconstruction of Ukraine, which took place on the 14th of March, 2025. I'm Natalia Kibita, and I'm a scholar of 20th century Ukrainian history and Ukraine's institutional design. I'll be your co-host today.
And I am Zbigniew Wojnowski. I am an associate professor of Soviet history at the University of Oxford, and my work has focused on the history of Ukraine in the second half of the 20th century. Today, we are honored to be joined by three distinguished guests from our Challenges to State Consolidation workshop. Today, we are honored to be joined by three distinguished guests from the Challenges to State Consolidation panel at the March workshop. Dr. Olya Homonchuk from ODI Global, Vladimir Dubrovsky from Case Ukraine, and Dr. Marina Utkina from the University of Warwick and Sumy State University in Ukraine.
State consolidation in Ukraine has been an ongoing process since 1991. Since Russia's full-scale invasion on 24th of February 2022, the importance of enhancing the state's capacity to govern effectively has become even more apparent.
And today we are going to hear from researchers who explore the challenges which the Ukrainian state faces in creating a favorable investment climate, as well as the opportunities which the process of post-war reconstruction presents for Ukraine in building a strong and inclusive state, one that Europe needs so badly for its security. Olya, Vlad, Marina, welcome to our podcast.
So let's begin with an introduction. Could you please tell us a bit about your research interests? Let's begin with you, Marina.
Thank you so much. My research primarily looks into financial monitoring, financial intelligence as an effective way to prevent money laundering and corruption. So it was like the very first and broad topic in general. But right now I'm looking into anti-corruption measures like corruption and reconstructions, how to overcome systematic barriers to Ukraine's transformation, as well as financial monitoring how we can to make financial monitoring, financial intelligence better to into managing of foreign aid. So it's crucial topics, I guess, which are very important for Ukraine's transformation in future.
Thank you, Marina. What about you, Olya? Could you tell us a bit about your research?
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me here today. My research focuses on poverty alleviation in low and middle income countries and provision of basic services in protracted war zones.
Thank you. And Vladimir, the same question to you, please.
Thank you very much. My research is about systemic issues of the Ukrainian so-called paternal democracy. So I explore it as a system and derive certain conclusions for the practical issues.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was fascinating to hear about your research during our workshop in March, and we were hoping you could share with our listeners some of your insights drawn from such a diverse range of expertise about the process of state consolidation, especially in the context of Ukraine's post-war reconstruction. In your view, what are the main problems which Ukraine faces in the process of post-war reconstruction? Vladimir, maybe we can reverse the order and start with you now.
I think that this is an underlining issue for the whole Ukrainian history, not only reconstruction. This is paternalism. Paternalism is the opposite to the rule of law. It is also encompassing such issues like rampant corruption, like inequality in opportunities, and so on and so forth. But entrepreneurial climate also derives from paternalism. And without overcoming paternalism and more generally speaking, moving from the limited access order to the open access order, Ukraine cannot prosper.
Olya, what are the main challenges in state consolidation within the context of post-war reconstruction, or more broadly, as Vladimir suggests?
I think the issues that Ukraine will face in during reconstruction are a continuation of issues that have been there since independence and during the war. My research focuses really on the lived experience of poverty and inequality and how that intersects with perceptions and corruption. Paternalistic networks that Vladimir is talking about. I'll start over. Yeah, so my research is focusing really on lived experiences of poverty and inequality in Ukraine and how that relates to legitimacy of state and corruption. Mm-hmm. In Ukraine, the poverty rates are quite high, which is usually not known to Western audiences. If we compare GDP per capita in Ukraine versus Germany, in Germany it's about 54,000 per year per person. In Ukraine, it's 5,000. Average salary of a school teacher is about $300 per month, where the cost of living is really high. And Ukrainians really, when they protested in 2014 and when they volunteered to go to war, it was of course for democratic future, but it was also for better quality of life. And if those changes are not happening, and if corruption and mismanagement of aid continues to happen, that already has and will lead to deep resentment from the population and can lead to undermining of the state or legitimacy of the state, because people want to see equal treatment of the of those in Kyiv with connections and citizens who are average living citizens in other cities. So I think that is a key issue, is high rates of poverty, high rates of inequality, especially related to Europe, which can lead to brain drain, and also this issue of legitimacy of the government and whether they're addressing long-term issues of corruption.
Thank you, Olya. Marina, what kinds of challenges, what kinds of issues does your research bring up?
I think that the biggest problem that in general my research looks in as corruption. So it's the big question, as well as money laundering. But in general, we can say that there are like structural factors due to which like corruption it remains. So it's a strong oligarchic influence in the national parliaments. It's ownership by big business interests of large parts of the media environment, tendency of large state-funded programs to award contracts to politically connected firms, as well as penetration by organized crime of law enforcement agencies and security services. When we discussed about like corruption and money laundering, you know, the biggest problem was that legislation unfortunately works not in the same way for everybody. So if we are talking about like officials, sometimes we see like a big scandals, for example, in the news or like in the media in general. But unfortunately, it's just in news, and these cases, they do not have real impact, I can say, real like implementation or something like this. So it's also the biggest problem. So I guess in general, corruption, maybe it's also, you know, maybe it's also about like a weak system of financial monitoring and lack of interaction. Maybe it's about like interaction between law enforcement agencies, which is not enough right now as well, because if we speak, they have duplication of function, which leads to lots of factors as well. So it's many, many structural factors and others, but corruption and money laundering, it's like the big issues in general. So I guess it's two factors. So yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much. I think this is, it's fascinating to see how your research connects the patronalism, the problems of poverty and problems of corruption are of course distinct themes, but it's becoming very clear to me how you are pulling in the same direction in many ways.
But they are not only interconnected among themselves, these topics. I agree with you, Zbigniew, but they're not just interconnected. They are very, we see the same problems in the world, right? So if we, in some sense, does Ukraine have, or should Ukraine have, or can Ukraine have its own ways of overcoming the problems that you are studying? Or is there a world experience upon which, from which Ukraine can draw from in order to overcome these problems? So our next question is very simple. How can the problems that you've outlined be overcome? And starting with your, so your poverty, and you've connected poverty with the legitimacy of the Ukrainian of the Ukrainian state, of the Ukrainian government, of the Ukrainian politics. How can it be solved? How can it be addressed? And maybe if you can say, can the world experience give us anything to, can we draw from the world experience?
Yes, Ukraine is a unique case. In many ways, we're, you know, lower middle income country that is experiencing paternalism and corruption. These are not unique issues to Ukraine, right? Many countries I work in, if I work in Jordan, they have the VASTA system, which is very similar to Ukrainian system of favoritism and opportunities. But I think the acute experience of that is because of Ukraine's position within Europe, because of physical proximity to countries where these issues are not as acute. And that makes people in Ukraine want changes so much more greatly and acutely. I would say it's just experienced more acutely because of relative differences to next door neighbors. So what we know from other contexts, what works is having pressure from two sides on the elites, from the civil society, which Ukraine has shown that we have quite a vibrant, thriving civil society, and also from donors, those who provide aid to Kyiv and the elites, doing in a way two-way pressure for change, for incremental change, and changing terms of the political economy and political settlement. Ukrainians have also shown coming up with their own creative solutions, which I find quite inspiring, and it gives me a lot of hope. So if there's, for example, a system of universities that has been inherited from Soviet Union and is incredibly difficult to reform, as we've seen for the last two decades, they set up new university like Kyiv School of Economics, which we could have a debate on that. But Ukrainians are coming up with their own solutions because we are in a very unique position. So there's a lot of hope for what we will see in the reconstruction period.
Thank you, Ola. Thank you. Vladimir, we can, of course, talk about the roots of patronalism going back to centuries. And again, patronalism is not something new in the world. Do you see ways of fighting patronalism in Ukraine? And I would push you a bit further and ask you this. In the current geopolitical context, how do you evaluate chances of Ukraine overcoming patronalism?
Ukraine is unique in the sense that it has a very high sense of urgency in fighting paternalism, because it is a sort of existential issue. Ukraine could survive only if it joins the West, the European Union and the NATO. And it is impossible for a highly corrupt paternal country, as Ukraine used to be, and it should transform itself very quickly. Otherwise, it will be just devoured by Russia. And this is, of course, a unique challenge to the non-unique problem. This problem has, I think, some solution, which is partly tried in Georgia after the Rose Revolution, with reforms of Kakha Bindukidze and Mikhail Saakashvili. There are three principles of such reforms. First of all, it is streamlining of the legislation, elimination of discretion opportunities. Second is overhaul of the main government bodies, such as law enforcement, such as tax service, and so on, because all of these government bodies, including, by the way, the court system, are penetrated by paternal networks. And in order to root out those networks, one needs to completely overhaul these government bodies, which is also a big challenge. And the third point is that we need an amnesty to past sins or even criminal felonies, because otherwise it would be impossible to apply the law to the to those who violated it now. And such an amnesty is very much unpopular among the people, so it is politically very hard to implement. The fourth component, which I would add, at least in case of Ukraine, is introducing checks and balances at every level, because the remaining discretion should be balanced by accountability, and accountability requires transparency and institutional checks and balances, also political competition, and participation of the civil society, which is quite vibrant in Ukraine. And last but not least, the control of the foreign donors, because it proved to be very much effective. This is from the institutional part of the schizers, and the other part of the schizers is societal transformation. I would argue that the system of paternalism is based on certain misbeliefs and misperception, even wrong values, that should be changed quite quickly. And this requires using maybe some, even I would dare to say, political technologies to change it. But it is doable, I hope.
Thank you. There is clearly a lot to discuss here, but we have to move on. And Marina, so yes, how to beat corruption? The whole world is trying to beat corruption. Every country in its trying to do it on its own, in its own way. But how can Ukraine, given its luggage and legacies from previous states, empires, and cultures, how can it install the rule of law?
So we can say that now we can outline key strategies to mitigate corruption, at least mitigate, not to overcome, because unfortunately to overcome corruption in general, it will take like not even some years, it will take like decades of years, unfortunately. So it will be about mitigating corruption in general. So the very first thing is strengthening institutions and rule of law, as I've mentioned, like before on the workshop. So it's about like strengthening institutions, it's about like strengthening legal system and to conduct and to create like independent legal system, which is very important. But as well, as I mentioned in the previous question and or my previous answer, so it's very important to make legislation work for everybody equally. So it's the very first thing. It can be like enhancing judicial independence and expediting legal reforms. It can be like expanding the powers and resources of anti-corruption agencies. For example, we have like a National Anti-Corruption Bureau of Ukraine, the High Anti-Corruption Court of Ukraine. So it's very important to outline their main functions and to outline their not to have like duplication of it as well. So the second scene is like enhancing transparency and accountability, which is critical, yeah, for like mitigated corruption. I will not discuss in very details, like specifically this part. So the third part, I guess, it's ensuring donor oversight and conditional assistance. About donor oversight, you know that the biggest problem with this is that there is no unified answer which country has to oversight according to it, yeah, which country, which is donor, or which agency has to do it. We do not know, we do not have unified answer, but for this we can say that the very first thing, it has to be internal procedure which has to be proved to understand how to look under like foreign aid, how to control it, how to monitor it. Unfortunately, right now, financial monitoring, financial intelligence, it doesn't work in such a way that we can identify this theme. And the first part, it's empowering civil society and media. Media, it plays crucial crucial part, it plays crucial role in undermining corruption. And I can say that right now we have like investigative media, investigative journalism, which is very important for our days, and it can shows like these corruption acts, corruption cases, I can say. But unfortunately, as I mentioned before, there is a big problem with these cases to be implemented and with the result of these cases. So I guess these parts, these key strategies, they are very important, but unfortunately, they are not, they didn't find, I guess, didn't find like the answer or didn't find the implementation right now. But in future, I guess it could work.
Thank you, Marina. Also a lot to follow here, but which unfortunately we cannot continue today. But I see, Ola, you want to say something, right?
Yeah, just to complement what Marina is saying and to react to that. So much, I think, donor focus and scholarly focus is on high-level reforms that are taking place in Kyiv. And we see many positive changes, in fact, over the last decade that are happening. From my point of research, it's important to remember that these changes are sometimes not visible to people living in small towns or rural areas or cities far away from Kyiv. The way they experience the state is in daily interactions with the hospitals, with universities, or other state bureaucracies. And so really to make sure that people are appreciating or like seeing the changes, we need to make sure that that's communicated. And also that part of the reform is we're changing how people are treated in those daily interactions. In my research, participants continuously said that they want to be treated with dignity when they come to a hospital, when they're trying to pass an exam at university. So that has to be part of the package of the reform. And yeah, I'll stop.
Okay.
Here.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I'm sure we can talk more about that. But back to you, Zbig.
You've all mentioned the importance of donor oversight, the urgency of reform, exacerbated by Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine in 2022. So I wanted to ask about perhaps the opportunities which the current moment presents for building strong and inclusive state institutions in Ukraine, and specifically the process of reconstruction as an opportunity for addressing some of the problems that you've identified. Marina, let's start with you.
Thank you. It's honestly the very great question, because opportunities about this, it's like the biggest one, I guess, question. So reconstruction funding, for example, it can be like conditioned on strengthening anti-corruption bodies, anti-corruption authorities. So we are talking about institutional reform and capacity building, the very first thing. It's like investment in digital governance tools. For example, e-procurement systems, e-declarations, which we have right now. But unfortunately, we can't say that they work in like fully or completely, I can say. So we have to implement new ways to improve it. For example, if we say about Prozora, it's e-procurement system which works on blockchain technology or something like this. But so these opportunities, they have to reduce bureaucratic capacity and opportunities like for abuse. Promote merit-based recruitment in public administration to reduce nepotism and political patronage. So nepotism, it's one of the form of corruption, we can say, and it's one of the biggest problem of not only of our country, but East European countries, I guess. So it's another one thing. It's about strengthening legal and regulatory frameworks. So it's about like beneficial ownership, beneficiary transparency for companies involved in reconstruction contracts, because right now we see about like reconstructions, it's a lot of it's a big question as well, but we have to ensure that it makes like equal conditions, I can say, for everybody, for all like authorities, for all building companies, or for all bodies as well. It's like reconstruction laws. It's an opportunity to use reconstruction laws to close loopholes in anti-money laundering legislation and enforce compliance with FATF standards as well. It's about civic engagement and oversight. So empower civil society and media to monitor reconstruction projects, ensuring public access to procurement data. Again, I mentioned Prozora, so it helps us to look into this system, into this auction procedure in real time. But again, unfortunately, we still have problems and cases with corruption, money laundering, and other stuff. So we say about improvement of this. It's about international conditionality and best practices. So we have to leverage international assistance by tying add to anti-corruption benchmarks. It's about adoption international auditing standards and work with external monitoring bodies, authorities to verify fund use. And I guess it's, again, it's last but not least about private sector accountability. So it's enforced strict due to diligence for private firms and banks to detect and report suspicious transactions, which is very important. And it's really crucial, as well as encourage the adoption of corporate ethics program and compliance departments. So I guess if implemented well, reconstruction can really serve not just as a recovery effort, but, you know, as a transformative moment, I can say, to rebuild Ukraine on the foundation of integrity, accountability, inclusiveness, resilience to financial crime, money laundering, and corruption.
Thank you, Marina. Vlad, do you see reconstruction as an opportunity to deal with the problems of patronalism?
Yes, of course. I would say that, first of all, the very war is an opportunity however paradoxical it sounds, because first of all, the people become very angry about corruption, and now the challenge is how to transform this anger into right direction, into fighting not some particular corrupt people, but the roots of corruption, which is paternalism and so on. The second is very, very crucial dependence of Ukraine of the international donors. Actually, whatever the donors would say, Ukrainian should do, because losing support from the donors would be disastrous for Ukraine. It would be an immediate and fatal disaster. But here the main challenge is that the donors, unfortunately, very often misunderstand the issues on the ground. Especially, it refers to the IMF, to the European Commission, and they do not read modern literature on the political and institutional economics. They just think in terms of 20th century and primitivize very complex and indeed stubborn things. They often act to the opposite of the desirable, because first of all, we need the European values. And secondly, only secondly, the European legislation. European legislation would not work properly without European principles and values such as rule of law. And they do not understand this and try to impose discretionary legislation, some legislation that would be violated in mass to Ukraine, which can even reinforce the paternalism. And the third is, of course, Ukrainian civil society, which is very eager to take part in the reconstruction when the reconstruction will start, and which can be a very good watchdog for the reconstruction projects and so on. The Ukrainian business associations, the Ukrainian civil organizations, anti-corruption and so on, are ready for this role. And now the main problem is how to end the war and start the reconstruction.
How can we get the donors to be better?
that's a big problem, but that's what we are doing. We are trying to somehow illuminate them about the real issues on the ground, and sometimes it works. Well, not always.
Thank you, Vlad. Olya, how can reconstruction help tackle the problem of poverty?
Well, echo also what Volodymyr said, is that we cannot afford to wait until reconstruction, and remind our audience that the rhetoric of reconstruction is really donor-driven because of the red lines of investing into conflict, active conflict zones. But that's really misguided, because if we wait until the conflict goes, you know, more quiet, the reconstruction will be very expensive. So it's cost-effective way to think about it, that we need to invest now so that social systems, institutions don't deteriorate, particularly social systems. And also want to push a little bit further what Marina was saying, is in terms of conditionalities, because there's many examples from countries I work where there are conditionalities on paper that never enforced, and then donor aid continues to flow. So how do we encourage donor community to actually take a stance and take action if conditionality is not met? And to do that, as Marina said, we need to not only leverage civil society, I would also argue leverage regional actors, which is oftentimes a weak point for donors, because Ukraine, as Natalia wrote in her book, has very strong regional actors who are close to the ground, who can see where the aid was reached the front line or wasn't, leverage their capacities and knowledge to monitor implementation. And then another route would be to do cross-sectoral coordination and aid, because of course, some of the largest amounts of aid are going to go to construction and defense. Is there a way that we can couple those investments with social investments and tie them to social protection, education, health, to make sure that those systems don't deteriorate?
Thank you very much. So the rhetoric of post-war reconstruction can be particularly harmful. We need to be talking about ongoing reconstruction and consolidation. Thank you.
Thank you all for these fascinating insights. Thank you once again to all of you for taking part, for participating in our workshop on 14th of March. I hope you enjoyed the discussion, and I hope we can do it again and push the topics further. There is clearly a lot to discuss. For our listeners, this podcast is brought to you by the Oxford Ukraine Hub, an interdisciplinary network connecting expertise across Oxford University with international researchers and practitioners working on Ukraine-related issues. Thank you for listening. I'm Natalia Kibita.
For more information on supporting Ukrainian studies, for more information about Ukraine's recovery efforts, or to learn about the Oxford Ukraine Hub activities, including our workshop series and the open access website, please visit oxfordukrainehub.web.ox.ac.uk and follow us on Blue Sky and Instagram. Thank you for listening. I'm Zbigniew Wojnowski.